Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. Yeah, well, we're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower here till 5 o'clock. It is Friday, which means we've got Straight Out of Context, Nick D Show Spies, You Big Dummy, and Fly Jams Friday. You'll also find out what's happening outside the Loop Radio for tomorrow morning's show. But right now, we want to have our first guest on, and he's our regular guest. He is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. He also writes for The Fine Print, and you can check him out on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, and that's F-I-E-N, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. And we always talk TV with Dan Feinberg, and let's do that right now. We welcome Dan to the show. Hello, Dan.
How are you doing, Nick?
All right, man. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
All right. So let's talk about Craig Ferguson's return to television. Although, you know, he is on the syndicated celebrity name game, which isn't really a Craig Ferguson show. but I do watch it every day. Because he's
really?
On it. I do. Wow. I watch it every day. And I think as a game show, as game shows go, it's fine. You know, it's fine. And I watch it because I enjoy game shows, but mostly because there are moments on the show where you realize, you know, as you're watching it, you go, oh, yeah, that's right. Craig Ferguson is hosting this. Like every once in a while, he gets to do something that's very Craig Ferguson like. So.
Huh, that's still a lot of episodes of the syndicated game show to be watching just for those brief.
I know. Yeah, that's kind of how much I like Craig Ferguson, though. So, Join or Die with Craig Ferguson debuted last night, and they did two episodes back-to-back. Was there a reason for that, Dan?
I think it's just to fill an hour and to give people a chance to get into the flow of it. I would guess that's what it is. I think they ordered 22 up front, so they have a fair number of episodes, and so might as well give people a chance to get a sampling.
Okay. Boy, 22 up front, I didn't know that. Jeez.
They seem to want to go into the late night thing, and so they just ordered yesterday, I believe, a Dan Harmon late night comedy show. So history is trying to branch out a little bit, and I think in an ideal world, the Ferguson thing and the Dan Harmon thing would be probably a good late night hour pairing.
I would agree. Man, oh man, I would agree with that.
I think that's what they're hoping.
Wow, okay. All right, well, here's the thing. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. Again, I'm a huge Craig Ferguson fan. I thought it was a very good thing to show the second episode after the first episode, because I thought the first episode was kind of shaky. I just thought the setup was a little bit... The second episode seems so much more assured than the first one did. And I don't know how much time there was between the two tapings or how much, you know, fiddling they did with the format or with the show, but it just, the second one seemed a lot more confident and a lot more like a show than the first one did. Would you agree with that?
Maybe a tiny bit. Honestly, I've seen three episodes now and none of them yet feel exactly like a show to me. They all feel like someone said, okay, here's a basic idea for a show, and then history said, okay, we'll put you on the air, whatever you want to do. And that nobody actually said, okay, is there anything we can do to refine this, to tighten it, to make it just a little bit smarter and better? And I was kind of disappointed by this. I am a Craig Ferguson fan, but not as much of a Craig Ferguson fan as you are. So I wanted it to be smarter, honestly. I needed more of the brains that I know he has, and for some reason he seemed to be steering away from that, it felt like to me.
I can totally understand you seeing it that way. I found it more entertaining than you did, and I thought the second episode was actually pretty strong. But here's the thing that I feel about it that I got from watching it. I think it needs to be an hour. I think the half an hour format, the way they set it up and everything. Well, what they basically do, tell everybody how the thing is set up.
The format is Craig Ferguson comes out and he announces the theme of the show. So the theme of the first two episodes were biggest political blunder and history's worst medical advice. And so he does a little, you know, he basically does a stand-up monologue where he...
Which is the strongest part of the show.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
And not, I mean, you know, the question of whether this would be better just as a Craig Ferguson talks about a topic for 30 minutes show, that's a different issue.
Yeah.
So he announces six things that are the contestants, I guess, in the particular theme. So for biggest political blunder, the answers were Rob Blagojevich, Herman Cain, Elliot Spitzer, Larry Craig, Christine O'Donnell, and Dick Cheney.
Right.
Your listeners would probably have at least you know, a rooting interest in one of those.
Well, I don't know about rooting interest, but...
but well, hey, once the topic is blunder, I think they could root to celebrate.
Yeah, but it was... that was, to me, you know, it was being a Chicagoan, you know, a lifelong Chicagoan, you know, and, like, right out of the gate, you know, like, the first monologue that Craig does immediately talks about Illinois politics. I was like, okay, this is like Ferguson's return to TV, and he's got at least three jokes in his monologue about how terrible the politics are here in Illinois.
And it continued also into the panel. So yeah. it goes from the announcement of the sixth, and then he brings out the panel. And the panel of the first episode, it was a random PR guy. I don't completely understand why. Comedian Jen D'Angelo and Jimmy Kimmel, because Kimmel and Ferguson are buddies, which is fine. And so after 5 minutes, they eliminate two of them. After 15 minutes, they eliminate two more of them. And then in the end, the audience in some way, shape, or form gets to vote on what the best answer is of all of them. To me, it just didn't feel like they structured a show out of this. It felt like it was kind of a, what is the least production we can possibly imagine in order to put a show on the air? Mm. And I think they achieved that. I think there's no structure. There's very little style. There's very little rule keeping. And I think it needed just a bit more of that. And if they were to push it out to an hour, it would need significantly more of that. And I would be fine with it if it allowed them to be smarter and have more substance. But I just wanted someone to step in and say, okay, we're going to form this. It's going to take some shape. We're going to make sure that things come up that are worth discussing. And instead, it kind of spun along for me.
Mm. Okay, I liked it more than you did, but the reason why I think it should be an hour is that there were several times during both episodes where I saw the conversation that could have happened being sort of stopped or edited, and even by the not in terms of just like in of actual editing, but I think that some of the people on the panel, including Craig, were editing themselves because they know it's a half an hour and they want to get as much stuff in as possible.
I wonder. I assume they shoot significantly more.
Yeah.
I assume they probably shoot 40 minutes or something, and
yeah,
then they trim it down. Definitely there were times where it would have been nice to get follow-ups, and I don't know if the follow-ups had to be edited out or if whatever. There were a lot of times where I felt as if I wanted everything to push just a little bit further. And in the first episode, I don't know if the guests were all that good. It was Kimmel being Kimmel.
Yeah.
Ben D'Angelo barely said anything, and Howard Bragman barely added anything because all he was a PR guy, and he had no historical perspective. So the second episode was definitely better. There's no question the second episode was better. I still think, though, that there's something I'm missing.
And
I think it's something that Ferguson is totally capable of doing. I just wonder if that's what he wants to do or if it's what History Channel wants. I don't know what the goal is, and that might be my problem after three episodes.
Now, you said they ordered 22. I'm assuming they haven't filmed all 22 of them yet. They haven't taped all 22 of them.
I don't think so. I'm not 100% sure on the 22. That's sort of what I haven't stuck in my mind from when it was ordered. This is probably the kind of thing where they shoot a handful. You know, they come in, they shoot four or five in an afternoon, and then they come back a month later, you know, based on people's schedules and stuff. That would be my guess. It's certainly not the kind of thing that they would do weekly, though.
Yeah,
it's possible that might be a better approach as well, if they added some sort of live component or some sort of near live component, because it doesn't feel very timely. It's all sort of nebulous, and here are generic historical topics, and here are our generic answers, and here's somebody being sarcastic.
Mm-hmm.
And I want there to be more than that.
Okay.
Then it'll probably do just fine, even if there isn't more.
Well, you know, I mean, there's always room for improvement, and that's why I was wondering if, you know, like when the feedback starts coming in, and I'm sure that there are going to be, you know, a lot of people who agree with you, Dan, about it. And I think it's a flawed show as well. But I'm just more forgiving because I love everything that Craig Ferguson does. And I think there's room for improvement. And I hope that happens. You know what I mean? I hope that they look at this and they make some changes and it you know, it becomes better as it goes along.
I think it's an easy thing to change. I think you can change just little bits at a time. You know, I think the topics were too nebulous. I think that the rules of what a winner or a loser is are too nebulous. So it comes down to what is the specificity of the week's theme? What is the specificity of the answers? How well researched are things? You know, these are things that require almost no additional effort. It just requires an extra 30 minutes of production a week from someone, making sure that things are in better position. So I think it could definitely improve.
Okay.
I'll check back in on it again.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'll be watching it every Thursday. I mean, hell, like I said, every day I watch the damn game show. So
That is remarkable to me. We maybe need to talk about some of the things you aren't watching instead.
Okay, I understand. Yeah. I knew you'd go right there for that one. All right, Dan, hang on, okay, man?
Sure.
All right. Dan Feinberg is with us from The Hollywood Reporter and The Fine Print. That's F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. And we'll come back and talk more TV. But we got a break here for the news on 720 WGN. Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Yeah. We are live in the Allstate studio. Welcome back to the show. It's Friday morning. Fly Jams Friday. We'll be coming up. Because it is Friday, everybody have a great weekend. It's going to be like 60 today, so you might want to run around with your Bermuda shorts on. So there you go. All right, Dan Feinberg is my guest, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. And we're talking TV, and we welcome Dan back. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you much. It was 90 degrees here on Monday in Los Angeles. 90.
Yeah, I understand, you know, and you're talking to you're trying to make the wrong person jealous because I hate hot weather.
So. No, 90 is actually over the top.
Let's be honest.
On the other hand, it was 70 today and clear and sunny.
Okay, there you go. That makes sense. That's better. I want to talk about the TV show Love from Judd Apatow. It's a new Netflix show. Now, when does this – did it start airing already?
It premieres. Let me figure out the passage of time and when Netflix shows premiere. I think it should be on right now on Netflix.
Okay.
I think it should have premiered in its 10-episode first season entirety.
Okay, so the 10 episodes of Love are on there, and people will be interested, one, because it's Judd Apatow, two, because Gillian Jacobs is in it, and she is awesome because she's Britta. So Brit is in it. And so how many have you seen?
I've seen the entire first season.
Okay. I can't wait to hear what you think of it. Tell me about it. And besides Judd Apatow, who else creatively is involved in it?
It was created by, I'm trying to pull up the names of the three people who created it. It was created by Judd, Paul Rust, who is the male lead.
He's in it, right? And, yeah, he's the star, right?
Yeah. He's the male lead, and Leslie Arfin. So those three. And basically it stars Paul Rust and Gillian Jacobs, as you say, as two Los Angelinos who are either unlucky in love or are sort of pathologically unqualified for love, but who still like watching romantic comedies and have kind of a false sense of expectations of love and as a result have a toxic view of romance. They are ill-fitted for each other, but bit by bit, they gradually get pushed closer and closer to each other, such that you know that eventually romance will bloom. But is it love? Oh, you'll have to watch many episodes to find out. It's one of those shows with lots and lots of awkward, hard-to-watch moments. Sometimes you will laugh out loud at things, but other times you'll just sit there going, oh, God, please stop doing that. You're embarrassing yourself horribly. This is hitting much too close to home. Stop it, stop it, stop it,
oh,
stop
boy.
It.
Oh, so, boy, really?
There are a lot of parts of this that probably hit too close to home, and part of that is because I think it's a fairly authentic and perceptive look at romance, but also partially because it's a lot like a lot of other shows that are on, only in some ways maybe better than some and maybe worse than some. So if you watch FXX's, You're the Worst, it's a bit like that.
Oh.
It's a bit like HBO's Togetherness. It's not exactly like these. It's a bit like Love, only it's not Love, like Girls, rather.
Yeah.
Only it's in Los Angeles. So, you know, and with the Apatow connection, that makes sense. So it's got a lot of tonal and topical similarities to a lot of things. I liked it largely because Gillian Jacobs is great.
Mm.
And this is a much more real person she's playing than Britta ever got to be. She's damaged. She's messed up. Sometimes she's funny, but there's a lot of sort of real pain coming from this character. And I think it's a great performance.
Oh, good.
Just so much better than anything else she's done, which is not to say that she was not great on Community, I just look at this performance and I go, wow, that's an actress.
Oh, good for her. That makes me very happy because I'm a huge fan of hers. Hell, I liked her in the Box, the Richard Kelly movie. I liked her in that, which nobody remembers.
I have a vague memory of it existing. I don't know if I ever saw it, and I certainly didn't know she was in it.
She's in it, yeah. No, I'm a big Richard Kelly guy. Of course, they ran him out on a rail after that movie, but
and Southland Tales, and Southland Tales was incoherent enough that probably at least some rail driving was deserved.
No, I understand. I happen to be a massive fan of Southland Tales. I think it's fantastic. I am.
It is a movie. It is a movie that is very ambitious. I do not question its ambition at all.
I have to say this, Dan. It's one of those movies that, and I'm sure you've had this in your lifetime of watching, film and TV and stuff. You ever have a 180 on a movie where you either you see it and you like it, and then you watch it again, and you go, oh, that's well, that which is a more common occurrence.
Oh, sure, that one happens all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I mean, it happens all the time, especially if you're watching movies that you have a really lovely memory from when you were younger, and then you watch it now and you go, oh, God, does that suck? I call that, I actually have a term for that, Dan.
What's your term for it? Because I have one, too.
Okay, mine is Nighthawking, because when I was 16 years old, I thought Nighthawks was the greatest movie ever. And then, years later, I watched it and I said, man, except for Rutger Hauer, this movie's a piece of crap. And so I call it Nighthawking. So what do you call it? What's your term?
My term is that the point of view is nostalgia's taint, because it sounds dirty, but it's also just plain old accurate.
You're absolutely
the idea that you look back on something with a certain fondness, and that fondness is nostalgia's taint.
That's good, man. That's much more clever than mine. Mine's just the name of the movie that disappointed me the most when I went back and watched it. But the 180, I had a 180, and it was the opposite for Southland Tales. The first time I saw Southland Tales, I absolutely hated it. I was just like, what the hell is this? And then maybe I was in the right mood. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. It came on cable, and I was like, this movie's awesome. So now I love it. Yeah, but I can't wait to see Love. I will definitely watch it. I happen to be a really big fan of Gillian Jacobs.
No, it's good, and you'll know pretty early on if it's the kind of show that where you're going to sort of hate all the characters and you're going to be like, I don't want any piece of that, because you're not supposed to, for example, love all the characters on Girls, and some people think that that's the reason why Girls is unwatchable, and other people find that to be the most sort of appealing and real thing about Girls.
Yeah.
And I think that this will have a similar thing, that a lot of people will watch this show and will watch an episode or two and go, my God, I hate these people so much.
Dan, I think you're not ever supposed to love every character on every show. In fact, sometimes they're despicable. I mean, the characters in Seinfeld absolutely deserve to be in jail at the end of that series. And I love It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and that show is filled with the most despicable characters that you could possibly imagine, and I still love that show.
I think that there's still something more kind of grounded and real about the characters on a show like Girls, where there's something kind of recognizable
right
in their awfulness that makes us uncomfortable, and we can kind of be superior to the awful people on Seinfeld, and we can certainly be superior to the awful people on It's Always Sunny, and we can feel warmth because they're caricatures, but we feel like if we watch something that Hannah or Marnie do on Girls and it's the worst thing in the world, something in the back of our head goes, yeah, but I kind of treat people that way myself sometimes, and we don't want to look at it.
No, you're right. You're right. Now, speaking of uncomfortable, I am continuing to adore Baskets, and I have to tell you, Louis Anderson has to be recognized somehow for this. There's got to be Emmys given to him. He's amazing in it, don't you think?
He is fantastic, and yes, it's always a question of when you can start the narrative so that people understand that this is something that needs to happen. And I've been banging the gong or the drum or whatever it is that I bang on Louis Anderson's behalf since I first watched the pilot and then, the next four episodes after that.
Yeah.
It's a spectacular performance, but it's a spectacular performance. And as we talked about last time, I think, you have to get your mind around the idea that it's not a stunt. And that's the thing that people are going to have to get convinced on with this, is that it's a real performance.
It is. It's like, and I'm going to go back here. It's like what Linda Hunt did in Year of Living Dangerously. Nobody ever really, you know, nobody questioned it. She won an Academy Award for that. And she just happened to be a woman playing a man. And it's the same thing. I know it's harder to take because it's a stand-up comedian and it's in a Zach Galifianakis show as opposed to like a Peter Weir, you know, critically acclaimed film. But it's the same kind of thing. Would you agree?
I would say that it's possible that the degree of difficulty is higher because I think in what Linda Hunt is doing in that movie, it is at its essence just a great performance, but the thing that she's trying to get around mostly is just that she's not a tiny man. She's a tiny woman playing a tiny man.
Right.
But what Louis Anderson is doing is he's playing in a comedy a straightforward, almost serious and dramatic, but sometimes funny woman where the convention is a certain kind of campy drag performance that he's not doing. So right. He's playing both against genre, type, gender. It's a very complicated thing he's doing, and there are easy ways of doing this performance, and he's doing none of the easy things.
Yeah.
He's just giving a performance, and I don't know that anyone previously would have thought that Louis Anderson was that good an actor regardless.
Oh, not...
You know, in any way.
No, I agree with you, Dan. When I first saw Louis Anderson in the show, and, you know, progressively as the... He didn't have a big... Well, last week, he didn't have a huge role in the episode that I saw last week. But, you know, whenever he shows up, it's kind of... It's just mind-blowing to see the kind of work that he's doing. Louis Anderson, to me, has always been, like, you know, a kind of funny stand-up comedian, and he hosted Family Feud. That was...
Pretty much.
That's it. And then all of a sudden, I'm watching this, and I'm like, where did this come from? I think it's a really remarkable performance in a genuinely original and crazy show that I really, really like.
Which one was last week's episode?
The one that's on, that was on, was the one where they babysat the kids. That was the last one.
Okay, and I thought that was a great episode.
Yeah.
But the episode before, which was the Easter episode,
That was the best. Absolutely, yeah. The one the last one that I saw was the one where they babysat the kids.
Which is not so much a him episode, but
that's what I'm saying.
I thought that was a good episode, and I thought it was an episode that got a lot of sort of the heart that they're trying to get into it, and I think that the show needs. I think the show needs that heart in order to be approachable.
Yeah.
And I thought that episode did a lot of that, but the Easter episode and the stuff with Louis Anderson at the buffet.
Amazing.
Spectacular.
It was great. It was just great. I don't know. How is that show? I mean, nobody knows how FX shows really do, right? I mean, how is that show doing?
It's not doing great, but it's not doing horrible. It's doing okay. It's probably less niche than I would have guessed it would be, but it's also not a hit. You know, at this point, FX does have the OJ thing, which is a hit.
Well, I want to talk about that. I definitely want to talk about that. We got a break, but I definitely want to talk about the People versus OJ Simpson, and talk about a few other things. And I love you tweeted out one of the tweets that you tweeted and that I want to discuss is you wrote you tweeted, "Why has Tim Meadows never been actively celebrated as a national treasure?" And I so want to talk to you about that. Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, Dan Feinberg, hang on, all right? Yeah, Dan Feinberg tweeted out, "Why has Tim Meadows never actively been celebrated as a national treasure?" That's a damn good question, and we're going to answer it right here on Join or Die. No, we're going to answer it right here when we come back. All right, Dan Feinberg joins me. It's The Fine Print, and that's F-I-E-N, and he writes for The Hollywood Reporter. Take a break, and we'll come back with more on 720 WGN. Hey, happy Friday, everybody. Yeah. Fly Jams Friday coming up in a little bit. Straight out of context, Nick D. Show Spies, you big dummy. We'll find out what's going on Outside the Loop Radio as well. But right now we're talking TV with Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. And you can follow him at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And Dan, welcome back.
Thank you much.
Right before we took a break, you did mention FX's big smash hit, The People versus O.J. Simpson. So the big story... Before we get into what's going on the show, they dropped an F-bomb. speaking of Marsha, Sarah Paulson ended the episode that just aired Tuesday night by saying "Mother blank" at the final final line of the episode after she reads in the newspaper that Johnny Cochran has been hired as part of the Dream Team. And she utters that. Now, has that never been done before?
It is not unprecedented, no.
Yeah.
Louis did one in season four, similarly, an F-bomb. I feel like when you say mother blank.
Yeah. It's an F-bomb.
Well, no, I want to make it into Louis Anderson. I want to do a little Family Feud action, and I want to get the survey says the top five answers, mother blank. So we all know mother lover is going to be
right.
One. But, yeah, so... No, Louis has done it before. I don't know the exact rules. Like, I think the rule is there are no rules. There's not the same decency requirements on cable that there are on network TV. So it's something close to a gentleman's agreement more than anything else. And so...
Does it have anything to do with what time it airs? Because I know that Comedy Central, like after 1 a.m. or 2 a.m., has shown the comedy roasts... uncensored, and so does it have to do with maybe they're making a huge deal out of this because it happened at like 9 o'clock?
Well, I think people are making a big deal about it just because this happened to be a thing that lots of people were watching, and
right.
A lot of people were struck by it, and definitely my Twitter feed was basically suddenly at the minute at which that happened, everybody was going, whoa, that never happened before, and
right.
The answer is it had, just Louis is watched by maybe a tenth the number of people or a 15th the number of people who are watching People versus O.J. Simpson. So this just happened to be many, many more people. And amidst the other strange things that Louis C.K. does on that show, you know, an F-bomb here or there is hardly the weirdest thing he does.
Right.
So I think that it sort of slips by in a different way. Also, the degree of punctuation that this was.
Yeah.
This was the exclamation point at the end of the episode. This was not a slip in obscenity.
Right.
This was how the gavel came down.
And if I'm not mistaken, I just watched it like three nights ago. If I'm not mistaken, there's nothing on the screen. The screen is black when it's when she says it.
Seems totally possible. I would have to go back, but you know, it's a galling moment for her, and that is the most logical reaction that a person would have in that circumstance. And so either you go the traditional network route and have people and have the person go nuts.
Yeah.
Darn.
Yeah.
Chucky darn, you know, whatever the thing is that would be the most punctuation, or you just have that person say what a person in real life would say in that circumstance, which
right.
is absolutely mother blank.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I got to tell you, you know, you've seen six episodes. I've only seen three. I'm completely addicted to this thing. I don't, you know, I watch it and there are things about it where I'm like, man, sometimes I'm watching it and I'm like, Jesus, I don't think I should be liking this. I just don't think I should be liking it, but I can't take my eyes off of it. I am so completely addicted to this thing. And I think that's happening to everybody who's watching it, right, Dan?
I think that there's a lot of that. Now, the thing I wonder, though, is if people are going to have a different reaction as the show, to me at least, gets better, but a lot of the things that people are finding hypnotic are going to be less relevant. So people are really making a big deal about the Kardashian babies aspect of the show, which is basically 1% of the first three episodes.
Yeah.
Nothing. It's just this little thing, but it gets stuck in people's heads. Well, guess what? It's not a major part of at least the next three episodes, and it's probably not a major part of the rest of the series. So I hope that the people who enjoyed making jokes about how this was the Kardashians origin story miniseries.
Well, no.
I hope they're prepared to actually watch the series now, because it's not going to be that. You know, John Travolta and his strangeness, whether you love it or hate it, you know, Robert Shapiro was the man at the start of the trial, but spoiler alert, folks, Johnny Cochran's going to become the man as it goes further.
Yeah.
That's just how history went.
Yeah.
And so if you've been hypnotized by how awful or how good John Travolta is, in your opinion, a little bit less of him in the upcoming episodes. But there's a lot of Courtney B. Vance. There's a lot of Sarah Paulson, and I think they're great. There's a lot of Sterling B. Brown. So there's a lot of the things that I think are really great here, but I wonder if the things that people are finding to be a little guilty pleasure-ish are going to go out, and I wonder if people will respond to that.
Yeah, well, I'm loving it for all of those reasons, and I can't wait to see more of Courtney B. Vance, because every time he's on screen, every single time he's on screen on that show, he blows everybody away. He's
so good.
He's unbelievable. So, all right, hey Dan, can you hang on?
Absolutely.
Okay, Dan, hang on a second. We're going to take a break here for the news, and then we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more about that. And then we have to get into the Tim Meadows being a national treasure. I mean, we have to talk about that. Okay, we'll take a quick break. Dan Feinberg will continue talking with us right after we take a break here for the news on 720 WGN. All right. Morning, everybody. Welcome back. It's Friday morning. Coming up a little bit later on, we'll tell you, in just a few minutes, we'll tell you what's coming up on the Outside the Loop show. That's with Mike Steven, produced by my buddy Andy Herman, and we'll get you a preview of that. And then our regular features, Straight Out of Context, Nick D's show Spies, and You Big Dummy, all coming up leading into Fly Jams Friday. But right now, we're talking television with Dan Feinberg. Dan Feinberg is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and he also is, you can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. And we welcome Dan back to talk more TV. Okay. Hey, before we get back to TV, I have to say, now, Dan, I know you see a lot of movies as well.
I try to.
Now, have you yet seen, because I'm actually counting the hours now before I'm sitting in the theater later on today watching The Witch. Have you yet to see, I'm a big horror is my favorite genre, and I have not heard the kind of buzz and insane praise for a horror movie like this, well, since like The Babadook, but this one, I've heard insane things. Have you seen it?
Well, It Follows came after The Babadook.
Yeah, no, I know. And It Follows and Goodnight Mommy, don't let, you know, I love those movies as well. But have you seen The Witch?
I have not yet, but I do remember I was at Sundance when everyone came out of the first screenings and everyone was blown away by those first screenings. But yeah, I'm probably going to try getting to it either this weekend or next weekend, because I do like those under the radar indie horror movies where they actually sometimes are genuinely creepy and spooky, and I've heard that this is in that category as opposed to sort of more demonstrative shock scare.
Right. I can't wait to see it. And I'm glad you mentioned It Follows, and both It Follows and Goodnight Mommy made my best of list last year for films, not just horror films, but for films in general. So I can't wait to see it. I was just curious as to whether or not you've seen it already.
So, I am looking forward to it.
Okay. All right. Let's talk Tim Meadows. Now, what inspired you to tweet, why has Tim Meadows never been actively celebrated as a national treasure?
Well, first of all, this is really an easy transition because we were just talking about Courtney B. Vance's Johnny Cochran.
Yes.
So, you know, into Tim Meadows also, who did a very fine Johnny Cochran.
Yes.
Easy transition. Okay. Now, the actual thing that I was watching when I tweeted about it was the Goldbergs, and he has just a guest starring role. He plays the principal at the school, and he says two or three funny things per episode if he's in it, and he gave a line delivery of something that wasn't even a punchline that was absolutely hilarious, and I was celebrating it. But have you watched the Triumph Hulu election special?
Yes. Oh my God, yes. Yes, I have.
So, yeah, that is a brilliant thing. If people out there have not watched it, it is one of the funniest things it's probably the funniest thing you could dig up and watch this week. It's
okay.
Brilliant.
By the way, Dan, I'm not making this up. I swear to you, I on my Facebook, I don't tweet as much as a lot of people do. I do the Facebook stuff though. I pulled a clip from YouTube of Triumph when he was at the Democratic debate, and so I pulled the clip. I'd seen it. I pulled the clip and I put it on my Facebook page. And I said this. I said Robert Smigel is a damn national treasure. So I said, and I'm not kidding. So in the same week, I did.
See?
I went to Smigel. You went to Tim Meadows, and when we both consider both these people national treasures. But no, go ahead and explain the Triumph thing to everybody.
In the Triumph special, which is spectacular. It's an hour. It's over an hour. It's like almost nearly 2 hours.
Yep.
It's everything you want it to be. And you know, if you haven't gotten enough election season mockery, it's everything. But Tim Meadows doesn't exactly play Ben Carson. He basically plays Tim Meadows going around kind of acting a little bit like Ben Carson and letting people think that he's Ben Carson.
Right.
And it's fantastic. And, you know, Saturday Night Live, Jay Farrow is doing a great Ben Carson. It is an uncanny impression of a certain part of Ben Carson's personality. But Tim Meadows' performance in this Hulu Triumph thing is tremendous, and I think between that and his appearance on the Goldbergs, and just sort of general reflection on the fact that so many people from SNL of so much less talent have had so many more opportunities to be worshipped as a star, and instead with Tim Meadows, we have to just relish these little moments where he makes something of nothing when he guest stars on a show and they say, oh, we don't need to really need to worry about writing something brilliant because Tim Meadows will come in and by virtue of glorious comic timing, it'll suddenly be funny just because he's saying it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, it's lucky to be in Chicago, to be from Chicago. He comes back here a lot, Dan. And, you know, he does a lot of work at I.O. He'll come back and just do some stuff at Second City. I mean, he'll do small improv groups. You know, he comes back to Chicago and does a lot. And so we get to see him on stage here, which is a real incredible treat. And, you know, is it him and Daryl Hammond, do they have the longest tenure on SNL ever?
Certainly Hammond is number one. I'm trying to think of how long is Meadows is right up there. At this point, Keenan is getting to be very close.
Oh, yeah, Keenan's been on for a long time. But Meadows, I think Meadows had 11 seasons under his belt.
10 years, looks like. I'm doing a quick Google search on that one, and the answer is 10 years, which is a long time.
Yeah.
And a long time where you just figure the number of people who got, and you know, to be fair, Ladies' Man was a movie that technically existed, and he deserves full credit for that. I understand, I guess, the challenge of figuring out how to build a project around someone whose greatest attribute probably is his deadpan.
Yeah.
And his ability to sort of twist things around a deadpan, and that's not always the thing you want your leading man to have, and so maybe that's been one of the things that kept him doing supporting roles,
yeah.
But
he's great. You know, I was just thinking back to, because I've always been a fan of Tim Meadows, always, you know, like on SNL, he's one of those guys who falls into that category as, you know, he's like the glue of a scene. He's always good, you know. He's like Phil Hartman in that way. Like, you could always count on them, even if they're in a crappy scene, to do something funny. The two things that pop into my head immediately Tim
also a treasure.
Yes, Tim Meadows did was, there was a scene where it was Chris Parnell and Molly Shannon, and they were visiting Will Ferrell, who was their doctor, and they'd misplaced their baby, and it was Will Ferrell was doing the weird Will Ferrell, you know, I'm going to say nasty things to your face, weird character, and he brings Tim Meadows in as Dr. Poop. And he goes, I can't help you with your son. He comes in, he just walks in, he says, I can't help you with your son, but I can do the robot. And then he does the robot, and he goes, that'll be $10,000, and walks out. And it's of course like a Farrell McKay weird moment. But here's Tim Meadows, and he does his thing, and it's hysterical. He walks out, and Farrell and everybody on stage is gone at this point. Like, they're laughing their asses off just because of this weird cameo that Tim Meadows did. I always remember that. And I always remember Tim Meadows as the census taker when he shows up at Christopher Walken's house and tries to do a census report for him.
Because the challenge of doing any scene with Christopher Walken on SNL has to be one of the great challenges in all of TV.
Oh.
No, he's just on a show of people who have always traditionally attempted to go as large as possible.
Yep.
He has very frequently been at his absolute funniest being as small as possible.
I agree with you.
Just nailing the little thing. And so that's why, as you say, you know, that's a glue kind of guy, is you want the guy
absolutely
to come in and get a laugh with a little thing.
I remember the first time I saw Mean Girls, and I mean, he steals every scene he's in that. And again, like you said, you know, the funny thing is, he actually, when they were right before they were filming it, he did break his wrist. So that's like a real cast that he's wearing, and they made that part of the bit. But I just vividly remember watching Mean Girls for the first time. When I saw Mean Girls the first time, Meadows comes in. He's the principal of the school. Meadows comes in, does a thing, walks out. I'm like, man, he's going to steal every scene he's in, and he does.
Absolutely.
By doing not much. And so.
And again, another example of a thing where people around him are giving big performances in that movie, and he just deadpans his way through one punchline after another that works really basically because of him, and because of course Tina Fey knew how to write for him, et cetera.
Exactly. Yeah.
These are people. It's not like he takes things that aren't funny and makes them funny magically. It's just if you're a smart writer, you know how to get the most out of what.
That's right. Absolutely right. Well, I'm thrilled that you tweeted that. That's all I'm saying. Yeah.
We have done our part here for Tim Meadows.
Well, I'll do 2 hours on Tim Meadows if you want. I happen to love the guy. Okay, Dan. Now you were disappointed that I spend a half an hour every day watching the Celebrity Name Game. So in case I'm missing some stuff and other people are missing some stuff, before we let you go, can you run down some of the best stuff that's on TV right now? Very briefly, just run down some of the stuff that you think people should be watching.
Well, people should definitely be watching People versus OJ. I think people should be checking out 11/22/63 on Hulu. It's an interesting show. Coming in a couple weeks, you got Happen Leonard on Sundance TV. That's worth watching. I think Vinyl is worth watching, and it just got renewed yesterday, so it's definitely going to get a second season, and we'll see how it looks in episodes that Scorsese didn't direct. No need for directed. And then, of course, there's all sorts of lots of great comedy, so everyone should still be watching Blackish. Everyone should still be watching Fresh Off the Boat. People can watch Goldbergs. Lots and lots of TV.
Okay. I do want to mention, I absolutely loved the pilot for Vinyl. I loved it. I really did. And
I liked it a lot, but I am curious as to how it's going to look next week. And I've gone out of my way to not watch screeners on a digital online screener because I want to see what it looks like without Scorsese on my TV.
Yeah, I know. I'm curious too. But I have to say, of the before we let you get out of here, Dan, the revelation of the pilot of Vinyl, Andrew Dice Clay, unbelievable.
It is spectacular because you didn't know he could do it, and also to see that he could do that against an actor as big and as talented as Bobby Cannavale. That totally Andrew Dice Clay revelation.
Unbelievable, man. Absolutely unbelievable. And I have to say this, 30 years ago, if you would have asked me, someday that guy is going to do amazing work and be directed by Woody Allen and Martin Scorsese, I would have said, you're out of your mind.
Who knows? And he's got a Showtime show coming in April, and I haven't seen any of it, unfortunately. But yeah. I would love to believe that the Andrew Dice Clay comeback is coming, and also that he's become maybe a little bit less iffy than he was back in the day. I'd like to believe that he has mellowed into a responsible and decent citizen.
I'm with you. Okay, Dan, we can dream. I'm telling you. Okay, thank you, Dan. Always a pleasure, and we'll talk to you soon. Okay.
Anytime, Nick.
All right, buddy. Take care. Dan Feinberg, he's terrific. TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can check him out on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. Always a blast talking TV with him.